Well, as you heard today, is the 200th anniversary of the birth of Margaret Fuller, who was well known in her time but is not so well known in our time. But this morning I'm going to read from about another Unitarian from the 19th century who is less well known even than Margaret Fuller, although you actually know something about her. So the first reading is from Carolyn Karcher's editorial comments on an article written by Unitarian Lydia Mariah Child. It's an astonishing essay called The Intermingling of Religions, and it was completely brilliant when it came out in the Atlantic Monthly in 1871. Now, you may not think that you know her, but you have sung her song. Her song, of course, is "Over the River and Through the Woods to Grandmother's House We Go."
I won't sing, but I'm tempted. Child's emphasis on the commonalities that link Buddhism to Christianity, and particularly to Catholicism, also serves an ulterior purpose. In 1871, some Irish Catholics were leading a campaign to ban Chinese immigration that would culminate in the Chinese Exclusion Bill of 1882. Child counters their stereotypes of the Chinese as unassimilable. I could say that word before. Unassimilable aliens, both by underscoring the similarities between the two people's religions and by describing Christianity itself as a religion that has assimilated Asian elements. Symbolically, the eclectic church of the future, which she offers as a model of religious and political unity, takes the form of a Catholic cathedral, but preserves the beauties of all ages and nations. In our secular age, the religious tolerance Child advocated may no longer sound radical. Nevertheless, the developments of our century, the worldwide resurgence of fundamentalism and religious warfare, the rise of the Christian right, the revival of calls to define the United States as a Christian country, suggest that the counter vision Child holds out in the intermingling of religions remains timely and relevant.
And so, since I've already mentioned Buddhism, the second reading comes from the Pali Canon, which is the set of the oldest Buddhist scriptures, of which there are a great many. It was written down, we think, sometime in the second century before our era, but it was oral tradition before that. This particular reading is from the Digha Nikaya, the Chakravarti Sihanda Sutra. I've removed all of the fancy titles and Baroque language, which makes Buddhist scriptures so often difficult to folks used to the more condensed Western style of literature. So this is going to sound just easier to hear.
A certain fellow came up to the newly consecrated royal sovereign and said, "You need to know, Your Majesty, that the sacred treasure of our nation, the golden wheel, has disappeared. We don't know where it is." The royal sovereign was grieved and felt forlorn. He decided to seek out the counsel of the local sage. The sage said to the sovereign, "Your Highness, the golden wheel's loss is terrible. But all it was really was just an heirloom from your forebears. So from now on, it's time for you to turn a much better wheel, the wheel of what we hold dear. Honor that wheel now instead. Cherish it." "What does that mean for me as a sovereign?" The sage answered, "Let the wheel of what we hold dear for everyone, your own household, including the children, the guards, your citizens, peoples of the city, people of the country, ascetics and clerics, even beast and bird. To those in need, give. ask questions of those who have given up infatuation for things and are now devoted to forbearance and kindness. Ask them, what can I do that will lead to happiness? And they will then join you in spinning the wheel of what we hold dear by saying, do not take life. Do not take what is not given. Do not lie. Do not intoxicate yourself. Do not harm others sexually.
This last Friday night, I enjoyed a lovely meal with my friend Fred. We ate at Andoshin over on Hamilton Road. It's a Laotian and Vietnamese restaurant with very authentic food and the friendliest staff imaginable. I asked the server if she attended the Wat, that is, the Buddhist temple, which is found not too far away on Bexvi Avenue. Now, if you haven't seen the Wat, it's a surprising Southeast Asian-style building covered with golden dragons and lions. It looks as if it was wafted by some magician directly from Laos and plopped down gently on Columbus's east side. The server answered me, oh, no. We belong to the Vietnamese Wat over on Cleveland near Morse. Hey, you should come on Sunday. It's our Vesak celebration. Oh, I know that today is Vesak, she said, but we celebrated on Sunday from 2 o'clock on. Invite the members of your congregation to come. They might enjoy it. Everyone's welcome in a Buddhist Wat. And if you don't know what Vesak is, Vesak is the Southeast Asian Buddhist festival celebrating Buddha's birth, Buddha's death, and Buddha's enlightenment, sort of like Christmas and Easter all rolled into one. I said, I'll let the congregation know, as now I do. But, you know, I'm a little confused, I said to her. The Laotian Wat had a big Vesak celebration back in April. Oh, she says, the Laotians use a lunar calendar, and we use the modern calendar. You know, it's kind of like you celebrating Christmas in December, but in Moscow they celebrate it in January. No matter, it's the same holiday. In fact, she said, I think all religions are basically the same at their core. They're just different because of culture, that's all. The culture people, it's culture that people are really fighting about when they talk about religious wars. Well, Fred and I really enjoyed our dinner, and we had fun talking to this wonderful woman and her husband. But I told Fred later, you know, I hear this all the time. Wherever I go, I hear this. All religions are basically alike. And I understand what's being said, I think, because everyone usually hastens to add, at their core, at their core. But that core is a tough thing to grapple with. And on the surface, the Buddhist concept of the Dharma, the Islamic concept of God's judgment day, and the diverse Christian and Jewish concepts of atonement are all wildly distinct, at least to me. A religious humanist reading Carl Sagan, and a Pentecostal falling into a faint after being seized by the Spirit, when seen side by side, makes those fabled apples and oranges we always talk about look almost identical by comparison. And yet, the great Canadian Universalist Angus MacLean, whom I quoted at the top of your Orders of Celebration, really speaks to me. He grew up in a remarkably strict Presbyterian family in Nova Scotia. When he grew into his mature adult faith, a Universalist faith, he admits that though time had changed his ideas about God and the devil and the Bible and the Sabbath, nothing had changed his ethical core. There he goes using the word core. And he calls his core truth-telling and honesty. The culture of Scotch Presbyterianism gave way to the culture of Universalism in his life, but his core, he says, remained solid. Now, that's exactly how I felt when I shifted from my childhood faith to my present one. I gave up a lot of culture, but I kept the ethical core given me as a child. I'd like to think that perhaps my Buddhist server at the Andoshin restaurant was talking about that when she offered me her opinion on religion. Maybe she was thinking, in fact, of the root meaning of the Buddhist word dharma, sometimes pronounced dhamma, which I rendered in the Buddhist scripture you heard this morning with the phrase, what we hold dear. The Sanskrit rooted word which Buddha used, dhamma, means, after all, that which we hold, that which we carry. The core is what we carry around with us, no matter when we celebrate Vesak, or whether we celebrate Vesak at all, or Christmas. In the scripture you heard this morning, the Dhamma, the core of Buddhism that a Buddhist carries around, is expressed ethically. Do not take life. Do not take what's not given. Do not lie. Do not intoxicate yourself. Do not harm others sexually. It's a nice core. But if there is a core to religions, is there not also an edge, an outer boundary? The seed-filled core of a Macintosh apple is not the same as the bright red exterior. The skin and pith of an orange is not the same as the juicy segments at its center. Does it make any sense to say this is not true? So are there core beliefs among Unitarian Universalists, beliefs surrounded and held in by edges and boundaries? Are some beliefs closer to the center, some closer to the edge? Is this the conversation we are having when we skirmish or debate about the real meanings of the words affirmation or covenant or creed or belief or faith or even authentic? Let me try to unpack this idea by telling you about a time when I really wrestled with this idea in a surprising way. Long ago, at my former congregation, a young woman who had grown up in the Sunday school there came into my office. She was really unhappy. She told me that When she had recently outlined her own theological views to another member of the congregation, she had been told that she wasn't really a Unitarian Universalist anymore if she believed something like that. Now, I was immediately appalled and disgusted that anyone in my congregation could say such a thing. I asked the young woman to tell me more. She said to me that when she was a child in the Sunday school, she had always been told by her teachers, by the adults, that she could eventually make her own decisions about her religious views. She was told she could study other religious traditions as well as her own tradition, and that was okay. She herself was to take up the responsibility for deciding for herself what to believe and when to be skeptical, knowing that she might even change her mind several times along her journey, and that changing your mind was okay. No one was supposed to make choices for her, however. She was free. That sounds right to me, I said. So, what did you tell this guy about your theology? She said, well, I told him that I believed the things that Jane Roberts received from Seth. Seth? I asked. Yes, she said, the personality, the entity that Jane Roberts channels while in a trance state. Seth told her that people create their own reality. That's my belief. Is Seth her name for God? I asked, not sure at this time whether I had heard of this religious tradition before. I was also in a bit of shock at the phrase, creating your own reality. I was wondering what my friend Stefan, who was dying of AIDS at that time, inch by painful inch, might think if someone told him that he was creating that horrendous suffering himself. The young woman wanted to know what I thought of her theology. I told her that I wasn't sure I understood what it means when people say they go into trances and write things down in books. Since the people I know who have claimed to do such things, ranging from prophets to shamans to reformers, have all come up with totally different revelations. But I told her that I would actually like to preach a sermon about her story, because I was still outraged that anyone would tell her that, and that I would read the Seth books myself beforehand in order to prepare myself. So I read the Seth materials, and it wasn't easy. They affirmed things that, in all honesty, I could not make sense of. It seemed to promote a view of reality that didn't overlap with my own at all. But then I read Jane Roberts' self-critique of her own work. She clearly owned that she thought that her imagination and even her unconscious had a lot to do with her trances. She was not really affirming necessarily that there was a being someplace outside of her with the name of Seth. The passages I read affirming her rational self-critique were very clear and unmistakable. And as I read, I could find no place in her writings where she gave instructions to any who trusted her revelations, which countered my own understanding of a core ethical life. She never says that some people are really not people and deserve to suffer. She does not say that some groups really don't belong to the human race. She does not say that anyone or any group of people need to be treated with violence, or sarcasm, or outright dismissal. The metaphysical understanding of the Seth world is certainly not my cup of tea, but as far as I can tell, it's not a religion or a religious metaphysical position founded on banning some people or being cruel to others or declaring war. So I preached that sermon. I preached a sermon to the effect that all of our chief historians had noted that Unitarian Universalist history is very complex, but that throughout all of our history there have been men and women who have come down on all sorts of theological sides within our living history. But what they shared in common, what drew them to our historical tradition in the first place, what allowed them to call themselves Unitarians or Universalists or Unitarian Universalists now, was our clear and constant defense of personal freedom and religious expression, our reliable tolerance of divergent points of view on matters like what kind of God a person believes in or doesn't believe in, and our tendency to reason things through by conversing with each other instead of trying to convert each other to the once and for all right position. Oh yeah, and that love is a more important lens through which to view the world than either fear or certainty. No matter what Unitarians and Universalists believed, that was the core, those four things. This, after you have surveyed our history name by name for the last 1,000 years, is what you will discover. No metaphysical assertion. There is a God, there isn't a God, who knows what the word God means. None of that is at our core. None of that is at our center in our history, going all the way back to the beginning. None of it. No decision about the precise words of Jesus, the meaning of Buddha, the feminism of Susan B. Anthony is at the core of our living tradition. My former parishioner, who loved the Seth books, knew that she was further out from the historic affirmations of Unitarian Universalism than most. She understood that, out at the edges, if you will. But she wasn't beyond the boundary. She had not given up on our core any more than Angus MacLean gave up on his core. So I concluded, please don't go around telling anyone in this congregation that they are not really part of our faith tradition. They may be closer to the edge than you, oh great one. But all parts of the apple are parts of the apple, and all parts of the orange are parts of the orange. But why, you may ask, did I read that passage about Lydia Mariah Child? How does that connect to this business of core and edges, boundaries and center? The immigration issues that we are hearing about in the news these days, the Arizona debacle, are hardly newfangled inventions. Immigration craziness has been a big part of the history of this nation, all of its history, including at the very beginning, when a bunch of European immigrants speaking English on one coast and Spanish on the other landed on these shores, crossed into these territories, and claimed everything for themselves without any regard at all for the folks who had been living here for 17,000 years. But look, Lydia Mariah Child was not focusing on that. She was focusing on something much more specific and local. The upheaval of some Irish Catholics in Boston trying to get all Chinese immigrants banned because they were so strange. The Irish American citizens of Boston, who themselves had been treated harshly when they immigrated, and largely because of their religion. Unfortunately, they succeeded in getting some anti-Chinese immigration bill passed. Lydia Mariah Child, a Unitarian with core values in her heart of freedom of expression, reasonable conversational approaches, and a broad, welcoming inclusiveness and love, she used the old-fashioned word tolerance, responded. She moved out of these core values to look for a solution to this immigration conundrum. And in her essay, she tried to show the similarities between Christian, but more specifically, Roman Catholic practice and Buddhist practice. She tried to break down the boundaries between the cultures and tried to show that at the core and at their best, both religious traditions were celebrating the overlapping values of compassion and community. Their great saints, Buddhist and Catholic, each lived equally ethical lives. Remember now, anti-Catholic prejudice was very high amongst Protestants in those days, and even among some Unitarians in those days too. So her boundary-breaking solution in addressing issues was a very radical one. Carolyn Karcher suggests in her commentary that maybe child's work is not radical anymore. She writes, in our secular age, the religious tolerance child advocated no longer sounds radical. Well, I disagree. I actually think her approach is still very radical. To actually find similarities between two radically distinct groups, to find ways to build bridges across the cultural boundaries that separate them, and then to actually cross those bridges, that still seems radical to me. It seems downright revolutionary. Whether we're talking about the legal, illegal immigrant issue, or theological and metaphysical issues, or even, yes, political issues, to entrench ourselves into final and fenced-in positions without any hope of building bridges, or entering into conversation, or finding connection core to core, means, as far as I'm concerned, that hope is dead. Dead as a doornail. And that self-serving cruelty is the only real God worshipped in the world, and I mean by everyone. And the old going to hell in a handbasket quip is just sober, hard-edged reality and plainly descriptive truth. But I, for one, don't accept that. My core values as a Unitarian Universalist keep me faithful toward a hope and a vision of a world that is wiser and freer than our present age. This does not mean that I foresee or hope for an age where everyone is united in belief and culture, and we have all abandoned our local cultures for some mythical humanistic commonality and utopian common civilization. To me, that's just a fairy tale. I think there will always be core values and divergent images at the edge. I think there will always be diversity at deep levels, emotionally, intellectually, and culturally. We're never going to be all the same. But our call as Unitarian Universalists, as I see it, is to make that diversity work, to make that diversity just and fair, to make that diversity a strength that frees instead of divides the world. Now look, I understand this is not easy. 11 years ago, I told a story in this pulpit, some of you will remember, most of you will not, about a very tall and powerfully built man in San Francisco, at our church there, who called himself Jesus Christ Satan, which is all you probably need to know about the state of his mental health. He entered our San Francisco church at the late night service on Christmas Eve with a can of gasoline and a bullwhip. The Christmas candles had all been lit. They were everywhere. The minister almost died of fright on the spot. But she knew that it was neither the time for welcoming conversation or fear. She knew it was wise to find some way nonviolently to get him out of the building before he blew everyone up. And she was able to find a way to do that. I'm glad. There are times, you know, when you have to set boundaries and set people outside the edge of your community for safety's sake. I agree with that principle. But all I'm saying is that it's not the final principle, and that mental health issues like his may be addressable someday, but certainly not at midnight with candles and gasoline. Festivals like Vesak or Christmas will continue over the centuries. They may take different forms, just as Buddhists and Christians and even atheists have all expressed themselves diversely and with variant metaphors, rituals, and calendars. But in the end, I remain thankful that you and I, my friend Fred, and the restaurant server, that Pentecostal trembling on the floor, and even Jesus Christ Satan in his purple cape, are all, each and every one, human, part of the great and mysterious wonder we call the human race.